This week on A Lively Experiment, big changes coming to some of the traffic patterns in Providence in an effort to ease congestion from the Washington Bridge. And the head of RIPTA is on the hot seat. Is his job in jeopardy?
A Lively Experiment is generously underwritten by...
Hi, I'm John Hazen-White, Jr. For over 30 years, A Lively Experiment has provided insight and analysis of the political issues that face Rhode Islanders. I'm a proud supporter of this great program and Rhode Island PBS.
Joining us on the panel, Joe Powers, chairman of the Rhode Island Republican Party, Providence Journal reporter Antonia Nouri Farzan, and former Providence City Council President David Salvatore. Hello and welcome to this week's Lively. I'm Jim Hummel. Over the fervent objections of biking enthusiasts from across the state, Providence Mayor Brett Smiley announced Wednesday that the city will remove a controversial bike lane on South Water Street near the pedestrian bridge, part of a larger plan to deal with years of traffic problems motorists will face because of the Washington Bridge replacement. Smiley remained steadfast after the announcement in his decision, saying everybody should just take a breath. David, it's great. First of all, welcome. This is your first time on. Nice to have you on.
Thank you, Jim.
This is providential because you were there when all this discussion went on. It was under Mayor Alorza. You were, I believe you were city council president at the time. So take us back to that time. It was a little controversial, but it went through.
It did. And at the time, there was a strong advocacy push by the mayor and some activists in the community to install bike lanes throughout the city. And where I live in the Elmhurst neighborhood was where the first bike lane or controversial bike lane was installed, and that was on Eaton Street next to Providence College. It was controversial because, quite frankly, it was the wrong street to test a dedicated bike lane in the city of Providence.
And they wound up getting rid of it, right?
And they ended up removing it at a cost of, I believe, $65,000. And here we are today talking about a newly installed bike lane, a dedicated bike lane that was installed 2 or 3 years ago. And now the cost to remove it and replace it is $750,000.
Does that seem a little high to you?
I was shocked by the high cost to move the bike lane from the road to the sidewalk. I do think the mayor has the right approach here. I think moving it to the sidewalk makes a lot of sense. Where I live in the Elmhurst neighborhood, there's a very similar model next to Nathaniel Green heading into Pleasant Valley Parkway. So I think compromise is going to be important here. If I were the mayor, I would probably just lower the volume a little. I know we called it an ill-conceived concept that was installed several years ago. Keep in mind, many of the activists who are coming out in strong opposition to the removal were involved in the installation. So I think like-minded people need to come together. I think he has the right idea around compromising. But the $750,000 to move it from the street to the sidewalk does seem costly.
Yeah, I totally agree. And are we going to get $750,000 worth of traffic improvements for that? I understand that the money is going also towards whatever kind of engineering they need to do to lift up the sidewalk so the bicyclists can use it. It's not just removing the bike lane. But you can just picture this being the kind of thing where one mayor puts this in, one mayor puts it out, you get another mayor coming in down the line and they put it in again. I mean, at a certain point, where does it stop?
Yeah, it's not a surprise to me because when I talk to him, he's never said Jorge Alorza by name, but it's clear that Brett Smiley is a different person and his priorities are different also.
Yeah, I champion what he's planning on doing because the ill-conceived concept of it, he's right. It was a little bit harsh coming out saying that. However, he's right. And I do think he was making a power move on that by saying it to kind of point out that fact. Cost of construction has actually gone up. It's not just like, oh, we're going to move a couple of cones and get people back in the way. They've got to pull up construction on curbing. They've got to move all the lineage. And then there's the workers that come into this thing. Will we see an improvement? Hopefully. I mean, we have to work for what we need right now. And right now, based on everything that's going on and the amount of traffic that's coming through the area, we need to improve it to make sure that the people who are actually need to get to work and get home again have the room to do it. And bicycles right now are just going to have to, you know, bear the brunt of it.
And this was part of a larger, he issued a 2-page press release that talked about other areas. This, of course, got the lion's share. I think, David, that the bicyclists would have a better argument if you saw anybody in that bike lane ever.
Well, not only that bike lane, but bike lanes that have been installed throughout the entire
Broadway,
city.
Broadway, Fountain Street.
Where I live near the Coca-Cola factory in Pleasant Valley Parkway, it's a beautiful, dedicated 2-lane bike lane that is never used. So I agree with you that the advocacy push needs to be demonstrated by use and demand of bicycle lanes. Look, cities are changing across America. Smart growth methods are being installed. Providence should be no different. But I think we need to be thoughtful in these policies and use taxpayer money wisely when we're thinking about installation.
The larger issue, Joe, this is the first time we've had you on since the bridge has been closed. I know, Antonio, you had done one show with us, and of course, David, this is your first show. The larger issue about the Washington Bridge, and so now the day of reckoning was supposed to be coming. That's postponed indefinitely. We're taping on a Friday morning. By the time you watch this, the governor will have announced the new legal team. I found it interesting that he put the attorney general at arm's length, did not want him to represent. So we're spending a lot more money like we did fighting the truck tolls. It's going to be a lot of lawyers making money.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you should say that. The day of reckoning, it's kind of like if we had made a couple of phone calls on June 5th instead of June 7th, the day of the D-Day, let them know we're on our way. We're going to hit Normandy first. So letting everybody know when the day of reckoning is coming, that's not how it's supposed to work. If you have people that are responsible for this, we need to find out. There's more and more reports coming out. Even last night, something broke. I don't know if you saw on Twitter where Ken Block had actually released something that AECOM had put in a report that back in 2012 that they should have restricted the amount of certain size trucks that were going across. And quite frankly, the RIDOT at the time said, well, never mind. Don't worry about it. We'll figure it out as it comes. So this whole surprise thing that's going on, it wasn't a surprise. To me, they knew it was happening, and this day of reckoning needs to happen immediately because, again, this brings up the whole idea of having an inspector general and having somebody that's in charge of doing these things to make sure that we can take care of the situations prior to it becoming blown out. And I'll go back to the bike lanes because right now, according to Ken Block, the report that was put in said the repairs could have been about $8 million. I'm interested to find out this three-figure millions that are going to be coming out in the three-year disruption in Rhode Islanders and the travel plans that they're going to have. Is this going to be astronomical? And if we had something in place to make sure that we're paying attention to it, then we could have taken care of prior to.
Antonia?
I have to say, I love the tweet this week from Dan McGowan of the Boston Globe. I think I'm going to butcher it, but I think he said, it seems like the only person who's going to face any consequences for the bridge is the South Water Street
bike lane. Yeah.
But I do wonder the way things are headed. It does seem like maybe this is something where you end up with a legal settlement. You know, are the details really going to come out if this ends up being lawyered and we're just trying to recoup money?
I think there needs to be accountability. I think the governor is absolutely correct in holding folks accountable for not necessarily any misdeed, but oversight that was not provided. But at the same time, this infrastructure project needs to get off the ground sooner rather than later. I know the governor's office and other state leaders have been talking with folks at the federal level. This needs to happen. Nearly half of the state is impacted by this. Small businesses, we know in East Providence and the East Bay, and even in the capital city, are negatively impacted by this. So the bridge needs to get replaced sooner rather than later. So while holding folks accountable, let's put a game plan in place so this happens not at the expense of businesses.
But it also doesn't sound, if you're filing lawsuits, that would be companies. It doesn't sound like anybody's job is going to be on the chopping block. And not that we want to be out for blood, but I mean, people in the private sector, you would have people held accountable and fired, disciplined, they lose a paycheck or whatever. I don't know that that's going to happen here. It just seems that the public is like, well, so you're going to, what, sue a company, Cardi, that doesn't have any money.
Right. Well, let's get the facts. Let's get the facts first, and we'll see what this report has to say and the direction that the governor and his team move in. I'm not suggesting that anybody should lose their job over this. However, let's dig a little deeper, find out who knew what and who knew it when, and then take the appropriate action at that point.
What about the way the governor has handled it?
Well, it kind of goes back to, and I don't want to pull up hashtags or anything like that, but you hear people throwing out the hashtag No Plan Dan. And, you know, there's really no plan.
Didn't you create that one? Was that your hashtag?
Plausible deniability. We talked about this already. So David is right. It's you know, when you look at this thing, like, we can sit here and blame whomever we want to. We can try to hold whomever we want accountable. But in the interim, there's still people that are being interrupted. I'm getting phone calls routinely from my Barrington people, my Warren people, everybody in the East Bay talking about how horrible this is. So they can sit here and point fingers all they want. They can try to sue as many people as they want. It's not going to go anywhere. It's going to get stuck in courts. It's going to be, and everyone's going to blame this one, and then this governor's going to blame the last governor who's going to blame the last governor. It's been around for 50 years. Everyone's pushed it down the road. It's got to be handled. It's got to be fixed. Somebody has to step up and be the adult in the room and actually take over and run this thing and get it done. Like, stop messing around with it.
Okay, we have talked a lot on this show over the last couple of months about RIPTA. The CEO, President Scott Avedisian, former mayor of Warwick, you probably know him, but he's been at RIPTA for the last several years, got into a hit and run. He was in court this week. There were some people in the police report who said that it looked like he may have been intoxicated. There's no formal charge in that. But now Governor McKee is saying that the board should meet to discuss his job. Antonia, he's already been on the firing line because Peter Alviti, the director of the DOT, is on that board. He and Senate President Ruggiero are not big fans of Scott Avedisian. Probably not good timing here for all this.
Probably not. Yeah, and I'm sure there's a lot of people grateful it's taking the tension off the bridge saga.
Thanks, Scott.
Yeah. But I do, I think one great outcome of this, it's probably not going to happen, but if he has to take the bus for a little while, that would be pretty great for the head of a public transit agency.
Hadn't thought of that. What about RIPTA, and particularly since you live in Providence and we're on the council, they're talking about moving the hub now from Kennedy. Did they talk about that when you were there, getting it out of Kennedy Plaza?
This conversation has been happening for more than a decade, I think, now. And, you know, that's prime real estate in downtown Providence. And I'm not suggesting that we should be building homes or apartment buildings at that site, but it should be used as a space that enhances our downtown while not interrupting public transportation. I think the plan moving forward, where they want to put the new bus hub, will be advantageous to a lot of folks who require a lot of different amenities and services in Providence, and especially our high school students. Our high school students would be able to walk within 10 minutes to their school. That could be an opportunity to enhance ridership in Providence. But look, at the end of the day, this is a broken quasi-state government agency. And it's a service that many of our residents rely on. But when I talk to folks, they don't want to take the bus because it's not easy to use. Mm. So let's create a system. Let's invest resources in a system that could be utilized where companies would say, hey, Providence in Rhode Island is a great place to expand or open up shop, only if they had a more organized way of their public transportation system.
Yeah, I got to start off by agreeing with Antonio because I thought the exact same thing. What better way that if found guilty and things went wrong that he got his license revoked and forced to take RIPTA and see what kind of job he's done. But I hearken back to the early days of RIPTA, and I'm old enough to remember using Kennedy Plaza area as the transfer to go to. I was going to OLP and going to downtown Providence was that's how you got there. That's how you got to the mall. That's how you did everything. I honestly haven't driven a RIPTA bus. I've been on a RIPTA bus in God knows how many years, but it's constantly in the news. It's obviously things that need to be fixed in this, and I think the focus needs to be on to fix the entire situation.
So you know who put her car in the driveway and took RIPTA for an entire week? You're looking at her. Yeah. Tell us about that adventure.
Yeah, I spent a week getting around exclusively on RIPTA, although I did have
except
to cheat
that you
sometimes.
Cheated
I
once.
Did cheat, yeah, okay. Yeah. And it's interesting, I've been talking to some transit advocates recently for a follow-up story that hasn't come out yet, but one thing that interested me that they relate to say is feeling that they're actually really like RIPTA as an agency, feel like it's very efficient, that the people who work there are really doing the best that they can with limited resources. And it's not like RIPTA doesn't know all the things I pointed out, right? They know service needs to be improved, that buses don't happen often enough, that Kennedy Plaza is kind of a mess. It just is a matter of actually getting the legislature to give them money to make it better.
You had a great comparison, how long it would take to get here from Kennedy Plaza as opposed to the new location over near the Jewelry District. David makes the point if the high school students are better, but there's some that it looks like it's a lot longer.
Yeah, it really depends where you're trying to get. If you're trying to get to the State House, for instance, or the Amtrak station, obviously it's further away. If you're trying to get to Classical, it's closer. If you're trying to get to, you know, anything in the Jewelry District, you're going to be better off. I mean, I'd have a further walk, but
yeah. There's also an affordability issue. Mm. These transfer fees are just not in line with what a public transportation system should call for. And I think that prohibits a lot of folks from using the RIPTA from time to time. You know, where I am, I live in Elmhurst. The 57 on Smith Street, it costs $6 to $10 to get to downtown Providence.
I think you've got to decide, are we trying to balance the budget or is this something that we invest in? It's like the convention center. How much money do we lose on that every year to say we're going to subsidize? It's almost like the fast ferry that goes back and forth to Newport. We're subsidizing that because we believe in it. It doesn't necessarily have to make money. And RIPTA really hasn't made money over the years. Yeah. So affordable housing is another issue. Well, we talked a lot about this last year with Speaker Sakarchi's whole affordable housing package of bills going through. Now there's an expected pushback from some localities. One specific thing they're talking about is allowing more density in some areas for residential units to be built in commercial areas. Joe, you're in real estate, and I know you follow this issue. I'm surprised the pushback hasn't come sooner. But it's state law, so on some of these things. So you're bumping up state law versus some communities trying to find creative ways maybe to get around these laws.
Yeah, and I mine really comes down to taking away authority from the local cities and towns. I'm not a fan of that. I firmly believe in, I'm a chain of command kind of guy from the military. But when it comes to rules and regulations, I think, you know, cities and towns supersede state. State supersedes federal. Federal can just sit around and wait for us.
The federal government doesn't think that way.
They try. Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think locally, I personally think that each city and town knows what's best for each city and town, not on a state level. I don't think the state should be dictating what could and couldn't be happening. I personally think they're going about it wrong as far as affordable housing. It's an economic problem. I really don't think it's an affordable house problem. It's an economic problem. It's because the economy is so bad that numbers are rising. And when you hear people talking about landlords and they're evil and they're raising rents simply because of the fact that they can, it's not true. It's like there may be one or two people out there doing that. But I mean, if you go and take a look at their insurance bills over the last 2 years, they've skyrocketed and doubled and tripled in some cases. I had a friend of mine tell me the other day, he went from, it was $75 a year to almost $200 a year that he's paying in insurance. Is he responsible for that? Or does that have to get passed on to the renters? So the affordable housing and then changing up zoning in certain areas to kind of force feed cities and towns to bring more housing in after they developed a certain area. And they have their zones for a particular reason, the commercial side compared to the residential side. I just think it should be left alone. It shouldn't be a state issue. It should be a city and town issue.
But isn't it inventory too, Antonia?
Yeah, absolutely. Ask anyone who's looking for a house right now. There's no inventory because interest rates are crazy, so no one's selling unless they have a major catastrophe. So there's just nothing. There's nothing on the market.
To Joe's point, we have one of the lowest vacancy rates of all time in the state of Rhode Island. And to Antonia's point, we have an inventory problem, not only on the rental side, but the home ownership side as well. We're in Rhode Island not producing housing for today's people. And while incorporating some density into these cities and towns makes sense, we're still only seeing literally a handful of municipalities reaching that low and moderate income 10% mandate. Every city and town is mandated to have at least 10% of their housing stock deemed as low and moderate income housing. It's still only a handful of cities and towns. The fact that there are some municipalities trying to circumvent the Speaker's housing package speaks to the problem. It reminds me of the school building infrastructure issue in this state. It took us decades to get here, and we're finally starting to make improvements. At what point do we say, okay, when is enough enough? When can we start producing the housing that meets today's demand? Look, people aren't selling their homes today because they're locked in at 3% interest rates, and they're not going to go out and purchase a new home at 7.5%. So I think there have been thoughtful ways of going about this from Speaker Shikarchi. The fact that there are some cities and towns who are actively looking to circumvent what he's trying to do is troublesome.
I'll agree. And inventory definitively is down. We had a meeting in December where you would normally see upwards of 4,000 properties on the market, and we had less than 1,000. Mm-hmm. However, to me, from being in the trenches on a daily basis, it's not from a lack of houses and available. It's exactly what David had said, is people aren't willing to sell. Part of my job is prospecting. And when I call people in certain neighborhoods saying, I have buyers, they're like, I'm not selling because I'm not going from a 3% to a 7%. It's stupid for me to do it. I'll wait. Call me when it gets to 5. I'm like, okay. And that's where the inventory shortage is coming up, because people just don't want to sell.
Well, prices aren't going to come down either.
No.
I think they've plateaued at this point.
Yeah, they're going to stay right where they are.
But the fact that in the city of Providence and throughout the state, the median price for a single family home is $430,000. I never thought I would see that in the Elmhurst community in Providence. So I don't think prices will come down. We could see a difference when rates finally start to come down. But the Fed recently announced, only days after they said we could see interest rate cuts later in the year, only to say in the next breath, well, that could be delayed now.
Yeah. And a lot of people of my generation, I bought my house 25 years ago. We all say I would never be able to afford my neighborhood. Now, they just did a revaluation in Barrington. And it's based, as you know, on market value. Yep. The valuation of my house went up $200,000. And I know years ago people said, hey, if you pay me that, I'll give you the house. They won't say that anymore. I mean, 30 years ago, it's like people would be appealing their rates and saying, who would ever pay this much? Well, now they probably pay that and more.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Okay. Antonia had a great story this past week. I'm going to call it the granny cam story. We've talked about the granny flat story, the granny cams at nursing homes. And this is an interesting issue. I see both sides of it, but how did you get onto this? And set the table for what it's about.
Yeah, sure. So this is a bill that's been introduced that essentially advocates for improving nursing homes have been pushing for. And essentially the idea is that if you have a loved one who's in a nursing home, you could install a camera in their room. You know, it'd be your camera, so you would get to see what's going on in there. And you could essentially monitor how they're being taken care of. So the idea is to protect against neglect, abuse, all that kind of thing. The nursing home industry is very strongly against it. They've said, you know, that it would be invasive to staff, insulting to staff, which I can definitely see. But I thought it was interesting that SEIU, which represents workers at the nursing homes that are unionized, actually came out and said, no, we support this, because they're saying it could actually help exonerate workers who are falsely accused. You know, if someone gets a mysterious bruise, it could help clarify, oh, no, they just fell. This wasn't anyone's fault.
Almost like the police body cams.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right?
I was just going to say, this is very reminiscent of the police body cameras.
And you were there for that discussion. When
I was there for that discussion, and there was some pushback by the police department. I don't think there's another group who loves those body cameras more than the police department, because now you can see both sides of the story.
Yeah.
When I first saw your title, when you set it up, I'm like, I'm not even touching this thing. He's trying to get me to go to some website. I don't know what this is. You could have named it a little bit better.
I was trying to get you to go to a nursing home, Joe. You're not quite there yet.
Well, make sure you save me a seat.
Yeah.
I do see both sides of this thing. And I think, first and foremost, from both sides, protecting the residents and protecting the workers at the exact same time, I think it's a smart move. I really do, especially if it's like basically a closed circuit. You're not putting this thing on the websites or anything like that. I mean, we have cameras like this at puppy camps, for God's sakes, where people can like tune in to see Fido running around with the toy in its mouth and see if another dog bit it or not. Why can't we do this with people? And when you think about it, a lot of these residents' places you go to, I have an elderly dad. We've looked into these numbers. They're expensive. Like, you spend a lot of money in there. Technically, you could almost, you know, make the argument that I own that room. And why can't I do what I need to do in that room to for ownership of it, the amount of money that we're going to be spending on it?
So. I know it's always held for further study, but do you get any sense about how, from the discussion, how things are going in terms of, does this have any chance of passing?
So I believe this is the first year it's been introduced. In my experience, usually that is not going to happen. I know there's also some kind of technical wording concerns that could be addressed. So it seems like there may need to be some massaging in terms of the language of the bill.
What I like about the bill is it's not a mandate.
Yeah.
It's not a mandate.
You want to put it in, fine, and it's for your room alone. I mean, the proof of the pudding was that the workers don't mind. And you would think they'd be the ones. I mean, the owners, are they worried about liability, lawsuits maybe?
I mean, potentially, yeah, that could be. I think maybe it's also just kind of a, you know, I can see how initially if you hear about cameras inside people's rooms, it does sound, you know, the knee-jerk reaction is, okay, that does sound a little Orwellian, which is the term a lot of people are using. But like David said, it's not a mandate. It's basically people can opt in, you know, the elderly person would have to consent if they're capable of doing so.
Okay. Let's do outrageous and or kudos. And I'm making an executive decision right now. We're going to do a lively extra because we have some national stuff we want to talk about that we're not going to be able to get to. Mr. Powers, let's begin with you this week. Outrage or kudo?
Well, outrage has to be the Washington Bridge. I mean, it's... Listen, I was upset over everything that's been going on with the amount of phone calls, and I think it compounds the issues is the amount of people that I get phone calls from saying, why aren't we doing something? How come nothing's happening? But last night's news break from Ken Block when he got the ARPA request finally goes through, and it shows that it could have been handled back in 2012, 2013. It's just another example. Another example of the just poor leadership in the state of Rhode Island. That's just everything that goes on here is they're going to focus on what's going to be good for them and how they're going to be able to, you know, progress themselves themselves, but they don't pay attention to what's going on with the constituents. This is another thing just gets glossed over and over again. So I, like every other person in the state of Rhode Island, is just outraged. Have a conversation with anybody in the East Bay, and they're going to tell you. People have changed their schedules. I have a friend of mine who doesn't have to be in work until 8 o'clock. She leaves her house at 5:30 just to make sure she gets there in time.
But also, it's a big thing now. We've talked about this on the show. If you live on the East Bay and you're going to Hendricken, or you live in Cranston and you're going to Bayview, there are people who have said, I'm not going to do this for the next couple of years. I'm going to pull my kids.
Yeah. I actually have two clients I'm working with right now. One of them works in the school department out in the Tiverton area. She's from Warwick, born and bred, loves it. Her whole family's there. She's getting a house out in Tiverton right now because she doesn't want to have to make the transfer.
And Whole Foods coming to CECON. Did you hear about that?
I did.
Whole paycheck. David, what do you have? Outrage or kudo?
Kudo. It's Final Four weekend, and I have to tip my cap to Charlie Baker, the former governor of Massachusetts, now president of the NCAA, and he wants to ban prop betting in sports. If you don't know what prop betting is, it's having the ability to place a bet on an individual collegiate basketball player or professional player or athlete. He wants to ban that. His challenge will be reaching out to every state where there is legalized gambling and asking them to outlaw this, this practice. But we'll see where it lands. States, I suspect, will be reluctant to do it because it will impact their state coffers. But I tip my cap to Charlie Baker, Governor Baker. I think it's the right thing to do. We want to preserve the integrity of collegiate sports and protect these young athletes as well, because I can see where they would be harassed if they weren't meeting certain stats in a game.
What a time to be the NCAA president, though. I mean, with name, image, and likeness and the transfer portal and things that you, I mean, they were penalizing kids 10 years ago for taking maybe free sneakers or whatever, and now they've got these endorsement deals. So that's a really tough road to be able to navigate. Ma'am?
I was outraged this morning reading this wild story by my colleague Amy Russo. So Providence Municipal Court, it turns out, was getting a lot of calls about traffic tickets, more than they could handle. So they hired this outside customer service company whose employees were incredibly rude to people. They were pretending to be City of Providence employees. They gave out legal advice, and in one case asked someone for medical records to explain why they missed a court date. Really sketchy. And the way this whole thing came out, which I guess is a kudos, is when the municipal court judges heard about this from someone who said, you know, they were really rude when I called. She called herself to this hotline. The people were like, oh yeah, we definitely work for the City of Providence. She's like, all right, give me a City of Providence email address. And they couldn't do that. So just really shady.
So was it a scam, or was the city had hired them to do it?
The city had hired them, yeah.
So they were authorized.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like the ticket you get in the mail from the traffic cam says City of Pawtucket, but you mail your check to a thing in Massachusetts. That sounds sketchy, right?
Right, yeah.
It's a collection company.
Yeah, right. In this case, it was a customer service company.
So what's going to happen?
They have ended that contract. They just did an audit, and TBD if there's going to be more that comes out of that.
Yeah. Kudos to Mayor Smiley, because I know he has addressed this issue regarding home alarm systems that have to be registered in the city. Mm. There was a company and a vendor that was located in Boston. I think they were called Cry Wolf, and you could never get a hold of them. Yeah. And they were double-charging residents at times for not registering their alarm systems.
All right, folks, that is all the time we have, but we're going to do a special online bonus segment, Lively Extra, when 30 minutes is not enough. So if you can stay with us, go to ripbs.org/lively. If you can't, we will bid adieu to Joe and Antonia and David. Nice to have you for the first time. We hope you will come back. If you don't see us Friday at 7 or Sunday at noon, we're all over Facebook, Twitter. We archive all of our shows at ripbs.org/lively. Take us with you wherever you get your favorite podcast. We hope you can stay with us for a Lively Extra, but if not, we'll see you next week as the Lively Experiment continues. Have a great weekend.
The Lively Experiment is generously underwritten by...
Hi, I'm John Hazen-White, Jr. For over 30 years, a Lively Experiment has provided insight and analysis of the political issues that face Rhode Islanders. I'm a proud supporter of this great program and Rhode Island PBS.
And welcome back to our special online bonus edition. We call it Lively Extra when 30 minutes is not enough. Let's reset the panel. Joe Powers, Antonia Farzan, and David Salvatore. Antonia, I was interested this week's primary, presidential primary. It's like, was there a presidential primary this week? Low turnout. But what happened in Rhode Island is happening across the country. A good percentage, 16%, voted uncommitted for Joe Biden. What do you read into that?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely the most notable thing to come out of what was otherwise a very boring primary, especially when you look at Providence. It was something like 30%. And I think that's pretty significant, especially when you consider this was not a particularly well-organized campaign to get people to vote uncommitted. I say that with no disrespect to the organizers, but it really came together at the last minute. I mean, the press conference to announce this was happening was 4 days before. So I think a lot of people didn't even know it was happening, had maybe just kind of learned about it from the national media.
Nikki Haley got 10% here, probably not a surprise. The question always is, Joe, when people say in the primary, I'm gonna sit this out, do they come home or do they stay home in the general election? And that's what happened to a lot of people that led to President Trump getting elected in 2016. A lot of those 2012 voters sat out. So as you look toward November, what are you thinking nationally?
Well, I mean, it's my job, our job at the GOP, as it is with the Dems as well, is to get as many people out to vote as possible. And, you know, we're coming up with every opportunity we can to try to figure out a way to entice people to do it. And I guess the phone calls that we all get, people complaining about this, that, and the other, they really fall on deaf ears. I think sometimes people just want to be the squeaky wheel and they're not willing to make the change. It's going to be up to us to really get people to focus on if you want to make some sort of a change, if you want to make sure that your person gets in, you want to be able to protect your seats that you already have, you got to get out and vote. And if you don't go and do it, you really have only one person to blame. However, on the backside of that, it's an empty threat because there's really nothing that's going to happen to them until a year or two later when they start seeing the economy doing what it needs to do. And now they start complaining again. And then by the time their election comes around, they just fall off. And it's just, we got to get them back out there. And it was a very low turnout as far as the primary is concerned. I think it had a lot to do with the fact that people were like, well, you know, Trump's going to get in and Biden's going to get in. And that's where it's going to be. I'll just leave it alone and call me in November. Well, we're definitely calling you in November because we're going to get you out to make sure you're there.
David?
I think Democrats will come home. I think there will be a strong push, not only at the national level, but here in Rhode Island, where the Democratic Party is very organized. It has a strong ground game. There is a lot of pressure to ensure that Donald Trump does not get elected to a second term. So I do firmly believe that Democrats will come out in November. There are some local races to consider in the city of Providence. We're talking about a school board election. So
for
the first time. Yeah. So an elected school board could generate more activity. But again, I'm confident that the Democratic Party will do what they have to do to get their ground game just as effective as it has been in the past.
Yeah, in terms of the uncommitted vote, you do have some Democrats who are saying, you know, people who vote uncommitted who are saying, yeah, of course I'll vote for Biden in general. This was just to send a message. I think you also have a lot of people who maybe will sit it out and be unmotivated, given that Rhode Island is a safe blue state. You know, we're not going to be a Pennsylvania. We're not going to be a key swing state. But I think it'll definitely be interesting to see over time what you're talking about with the school board, with those local elections. How did those drive turnout? Especially because for this past election, I don't think the Rhode Island Democratic Party really did a lot to try and get people out to vote for Biden, at least not anything I was aware of. So when you do have a more concerted push in November, do things start to look different?
There was a lot of talk in 2020 about Gen Z, Gen X, millennials that really kind of helped. There was a concerted effort to have them come out in 2020. And I wonder what the vibe now is. I mean, you can't buy a house. Interest rates are high. It costs you half a paycheck to go to the grocery store, all of that. Does that encourage you to vote, or does that, and I know you don't speak for all of those three demographics, or does that make you apathetic and think no matter what I do, it's going to be this way?
I think it does make a lot of people apathetic. Yeah, absolutely. It's sad to say.
Yeah, I firmly believe there's going to be a huge groundswell as far as Republicans coming out, because right now, and David may think it's going to go on the Democrat side, but to avoid Donald Trump being in, but there's no doubting that The economy was 10 times better when Donald Trump was in place. And I think that's where everybody's focus is. People aren't sitting here worrying about these emotional football conversations that they're having. They're sitting at their kitchen table trying to figure out how they're going to pay for bread that has gone up 94%, and how they're going to pay for eggs, how they're going to pay for the kids to get back and forth in school. How can they afford RIPTA because they can't afford the Ubers anymore or anything? The economy right now is really what I think is going to drive. It's our job to make sure that people are aware of this, because there has to be a change. We can't. This is not sustainable.
But didn't the Republicans misjudge the midterms about where abortion fit in? I mean, I understand economy, and I'm right there when I have to spend a lot more. Gas is, you know, you can argue gas, it goes up, it goes down. But now it's going to be on the ballot in Florida, which is a key battleground state. You now have a Supreme Court that talked about the 6 weeks, the 15, but it's up to the states, what you talked about, states' rights. Didn't the Republicans misjudge that? You thought it was going to be the big red wave in the midterms? And it didn't materialize.
They definitely misjudged it, and I think it was because they got sucked up into the emotional football. And what I mean by that is, like, whenever somebody wants to create emotion from people, they'll bring up those topics such as abortion. And quite frankly, the Democrats don't even talk about abortion anymore. They changed the name of it just to try and make it seem like there was more of an impact on an individual's health concerns and health rights. Quite frankly, abortion really shouldn't even play a role in any of this, because it's just the political emotional football that gets kicked down the line. Take a look at in the year 2000. There was over 5,000 abortions that happened in the state of Rhode Island. As of 2021, there was 1,500. So there's not even, like, the numbers have even gone down. There's not even, like, a real call for it anymore. But that's going to be the emotional football that comes out, and it's our job to keep people on track of what's really going to affect Rhode Island moving forward. And abortion isn't it. It's going to be the economy. Without question, the economy is horrible right now. It's proof positive that everything that goes on in the state of Rhode Island has just been a complete failure as far as the leadership is concerned, because now that the economy is so bad, you're seeing rises in prices on things that could have been fixed years ago, but they kept pushing it down the line. The bridges, the bike paths, and the money that they're spending, now everything is double and triple in the cost. It's going to see from the political side right down to the kitchen table, which is everybody's focus.
Maybe not Rhode Island, but don't you think what the Supreme Court decides and some of the major decisions that have gone on in education and health care, doesn't that factor into voters' minds?
I do. I do think they factor in, and these aren't single-issue voters. In reproductive rights, that is an important topic for a lot of voters in Rhode Island and nationally. And we've seen how political the Supreme Court has become, right? And the fact that rights are being taken away from women as a result of how politicized the Supreme Court is, I do think will get folks out to vote. Yes, the economy is important to people and what their grocery tabs look like, but again, these aren't single-issue voters, although reproductive rights is at the top of that list, I believe.
You get the final word.
Okay. I mean, you mentioned bridges. I wonder if part of the calculus also is who's going to get us more money for the new bridge that we need. You know, being a blue state, potentially, having a Democratic administration, what we've been getting a lot of federal funding coming in, is that going to change if you have a Republican?
Yeah. And that was the argument. Well, and John Chafee used that argument for years. And he's a different kind of Republican than I think you have in a lot of Congress today. But he said it's always good to have somebody in the opposite party, because it's going to shift, isn't it?
And we don't.
And think of how much money John Chafee brought in over the years.
Yeah, and you're 100% right. You have one-party rule, nothing's ever going to get done. People get complacent, they get comfortable, and they don't actually make any real moves. They're just doing things that are going to work for them.
All right. Well, what is getting done now in Washington?
Well, that's the
with the Democratic rule. You're right. I agree with you. Thank you.
It's a Republican-led House.
Yeah. Well, we'll see, and it'll be interesting. That will be for another show, whether it's going to flip and how the Senate and the House, folks. Even with Lively Extra, we don't have enough time. That is all the time we have. Joe and Antonia and David, thank you for spending a little extra time. Come back here next week as a Lively Experiment continues.